This is Democracy,
a podcast about the people of the United States,
a podcast about citizenship,
about engaging with politics and the world around you,
a podcast about educating yourself on today's important issues
and how to have a voice in what happens next.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. Today, we are going to discuss the whirlwind of events in Syria in the last few weeks, really in the last 13 years. What we have seen in the last few weeks with the collapse of the Assad regime is the end of a regime that had been in power for 50 years, that had also been in civil war with massive casualties and brutality for more than a decade, going back to at least 2010. And we're going to discuss today what has happened, but even more than the policy issues, what this means for human beings on the ground, because there are more than 20 million people who are directly affected, probably far more than 20 million people, by the events of the last few days and the last few decades. We are very fortunate to be joined by a good friend and someone who I have such high regard for, a former student of mine, but now an international activist and leader, May Barazi. May, welcome.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
So nice to see you. May is doing really amazing work. For more than a decade, she has been working on international refugee and resettlement issues, working with families and individuals around the world from Syria, but also in Ethiopia and elsewhere, who have been forced to flee their homes because of violence. In the ways that many of our families did generations ago, certainly my family. And she has worked with helping them to resettle, helping them to these families, these refugees, to start their lives over again. And of course, she's from Syria, May is, so this is a country that's very close to her heart. She spent the first half of her life there, and she's an expert on refugee issues. So what we're seeing today is directly in her space, personally and professionally. And May will help us understand what's happening and what the implications are for these events and for the many, many people affected by these events in Syria. Before we turn to that discussion, of course, we have our scene-setting poem from Mr. Zachary Suri. Zachary, what's your poem's title today?
At Once.
Okay, let's hear it.
From 1,000 miles away, they watch the freedom of their land return and see the faces from the dungeons long since disappeared, and hear the laughter of their countrymen, for once at peace, finding in their own children's eyes the love that they had lost. So swiftly does the tyrant fall, not slowly but at once. So swiftly do the gunshots end, not slowly but at once. And just like that can hope return, not slowly but at once.
Tell us, Zachary, what motivated you to write this poem?
Well, the thing that struck me about watching these events unfold from the U.S. is how sudden they were. And despite the prolonged horrors of the civil war in Syria, how the end, the hopeful end, came so quickly and so suddenly, when at least I was least expecting it. And there's something very powerful in that. It's almost cathartic. And I think in some ways it almost adds to the sense of emotion surrounding the event.
Yes, yes. May, your thoughts on the poem?
Hope. Hope. The images coming after the fall of the regime are scary. We always knew there were horror and torture and pain. But when you see it, you see the images of not just the people coming out of the cells, but their families waiting. Mothers, fathers, children waiting for their parents to come out. Some did, looking different, acting different, because they've been there for many, many, many years. So they became like strangers to them. Some never came out. And the hope is gone. So the hope is true for some, but not for everybody. And I think the word sad is not the word we're looking for now. I don't know what to use, but there's this bitterness inside, the fear, and but we want to keep the hope. We want to.
Of course. And what makes you most hopeful now?
The young people. I've been very lucky. Right after I finished my master's degree in 2018, I think you guys really put something inside of me that said, you know, I need to do more. I was involved somehow, supporting families and friends. But after I finished, I contacted some people I knew on social media. Facebook was very popular at that time. They were working with displaced Syrians in the north. Mm-hmm. And I said, what can I do? They were providing English classes, literacy, and they were targeting especially women. Mm. So I said, can I teach communication skills, peaceful communication? I don't know why, but that's the first thing that came to mind. And they said, of course. At that time, our only platform was Skype. You dial Skype and then you start talking to people. So we were online since then. And I started working with women. They would come to this, like, what we call women's center, bunch of women, and sometimes with their children and babies in their lap.
Wow. And these were all people displaced because of the Civil War.
Yes, so they were displaced. They come from all different cities and towns in Syria. We'll probably talk about it a little bit more later, but they were pushed away because they opposed the Assad regime. So they end up in the north, and we wanted to help them cope. A lot of them were in tents, living in tents. That's mm-hmm. why we had a place for them to come to. So there's an internet, and there's a computer and a screen. And we would teach them, especially in my session, on how to communicate. We will identify conflicts and families, and they'll say, okay, how do we deal with it? And then bit and bit, we start talking about conflicts in communities, conflict with people who have different opinion. Mm. And since 2018, we have about 2,000 students graduated, finishing a 60-hour program. It's a part of George Mason University, mm-hmm. peace-building program. The organization I work with is called Tastakel, which is meaning independent. And we started with women, but now we, for the past, I think, 3 or 4 years, we've been teaching women and men. Mm. Because we don't want to just address half of the society, but all of the society. And the best part is what I learn from them, not what I teach them.
Yeah.
I learn so much from them. These are survivors who, some of them, been displaced once, twice, three times. Survived bombs and shootings, and they have hope.
Yeah.
Talking about hope, they always had hope.
So much of the world, I feel, had lost hope in Syria. In 2010, 2011, President Obama believed that the Arab Spring would somehow lead to the downfall of the Assad regime. And of course, that didn't happen. In fact, the opposite happened. The Assad regime increased its use of military activities, including chemical weapons, against its own people, bringing in assistance from Russia and Iran and Hezbollah. And so the situation became, at least for those looking from the outside, and I'm sure for those inside, more and more grim. As we were talking before, half the population about of Syria left as refugees, ran away if they could. Who knows how many hundreds of thousands were killed. How did we, in the last few weeks, come out of that? What has happened? What have you experienced? Not just from a policy perspective, but a personal perspective. How have things changed in the last few weeks?
I think the results that we're seeing now have been planned maybe for years and years. I mean, the Syrians never lost hope. They always said, there's no way this is going to continue. It's just too much. So I am sure many Syrians on different levels been planning for the day after, as we say. A lot of the young people we're seeing now, they call the opposition or you know, HTS, I think the letters they're using for the opposition now, they have been training. These young men have been displaced from their homes, and now we're seeing images for them coming back to their homes, whether destroyed or not. They go back and they hug their families and friends. So I remember seeing a video of two children, and they were like 10 years old when they left their home, and they said, "We will be back." And now they're back.
Wow, 10 years later.
Yes,
wow.
yes. It's amazing.
It is.
So these people always wanted to go back to their homes. And a lot happened. I'm not a political analyst, so I cannot give you exactly how it happened. But what we've seen on the news is that, for example, Russia got busy in Ukraine. Russia's been supporting Assad since 2014 or 2015. Iran and Hezbollah have been giving Assad support since day one. First, they said just administrative, and then the troops walked in. So Iran got weakened, Hezbollah, big part of it was destroyed. So all of this gave room for this move that's been long awaited. And that's what we've been seeing.
Where have they been training?
I cannot give you exactly the location, but all of these people were in the north west part of Syria, which is on the border with Turkey.
Right.
And I mean, we all know that Turkey is a supporter of them.
Right.
So this is where they were.
And there are also American soldiers there, as I understand it, 800 American soldiers or so.
They are in the north also. There's there's actually a lot of American in the north supporting also the Kurds.
Yes.
So we were afraid that now there might be a clash between the two, because Turkish supporting the opposition and America supporting the Kurds, and they might have different agendas. We're hoping that, since they're both Syrians, that they will talk together and figure out a way out.
Zachary?
Could you give us a better sense, maybe, from what you know, of who the main opposition are? What do they believe? What do they want to do with the country moving forward? Or is it all too soon to tell?
It is soon, but there are indications. So, you know, the Ahmed al-Sharr, now he introduced himself, the Jolani. He was, for, I think, since 2013 or 14, fighting against al-Assad. He had different affiliations with al-Qaeda or others. On a CNN interview, he introduced himself and he said, "People go through phases, and now my project is Syria." So we're hoping that, yes, his project is just to provide you know, peace and democracy to Syria. The young people who he's leading, they're from all over Syria, and they were all displaced because of the Assad. So I understand their feelings. Now, the thing that I need to be very careful saying, but it is kind of a fact, but not an announced fact, is that usually whoever is funding have the agenda.
Right.
We're hoping that it's a good agenda for Syria. So far, we've seen a very peaceful transition. I mean, not much of a, there's no bloodshed actually at all, and some incidents happening here or there, especially in the north. Most of the people have probably seen them starting in Aleppo, going to Hama, and then Damascus and Homs and the Dara in the south. They were welcoming them. And I talked to friends who lives in Aleppo and Homs and Hama, and as they were marching to these cities, I would call and say, how you're doing? They were like, we're fine, we're fine. They said they're going to give us more electricity because for the past 5 years, a lot of Syrians have electricity only a couple hours per day.
Wow.
And beside many other obstacles, they've been living on daily basis. So now they said, oh, there's bread and there's food, because we thought as they come in, there will be a big conflict, a crisis, and maybe the basic services will disappear. No, everything was fine. And they said they were organized. And the people welcomed them, and they were very polite, very nice. So we're hoping this will continue.
Yes, yes. I know you're from Hama, which mm-hmm. is a major city in Syria, third or fourth largest, is that correct?
Number four, yeah.
Number fourth largest, in a country of 20-some-odd million. So mm-hmm. this is a big city, right?
Yeah.
Probably more than a million people, yeah?
Yeah, about a million plus,
it's the
yeah.
It's your home, it's the city you're from. Yes?
I was born, actually, and raised in Damascus.
Okay.
My parents from Hama. We used to visit Hama a lot. Hama had went out against Assad regime in 1982. My father was there. He would always move between Hama and Damascus. And all of a sudden, we could not hear anything from him. At that time, there were no smartphones or internet. There's the dial phones.
Mm-hmm.
He was there for about 22 days. The city was under siege, and it was bombed by Hafez al-Assad and his brother Rifat al-Assad, very well-known criminal. The numbers of how many people were killed was between 20 to 40,000 people. I remember we would keep trying to call my father to hear any news from him. We couldn't. So sometimes we would call a cousin, the phone would work, and we'd say, do you know what's happening? And the news coming out would say, there are neighborhoods that were wiped out. We don't know if the neighborhood, which it's a neighborhood called the Barazi neighborhood.
Okay.
It's a big family there.
Your neighborhood.
Yes. We don't know if it's still there or not. Now, 22 days later, my father walks in. I was 12 years old, and I was scared to go and hug him. I saw a ghost. I didn't see my father. My father was very strong. He was a police officer before. His shoulders and were bent down, and his face... I still remember it exactly when he walked in. It was like gray, sad. He was staring. Mom was telling me, go say hello. And I went and touched him, but I was afraid. It took him a very long time to recover. And now we understand what is PTSD.
Of course.
At that time, we just know. And dad went through a lot during those 22 days. One story that I heard from my siblings, not from him, because I was too young, they would go to a neighborhood and ask for the men to come out, and they will just line them out in front of a wall and shoot them. So he was lined up in front of a wall, and they would collect their IDs. So the soldier next to him, an officer, were reading the names just to make sure that they all deserve death.
Mm.
And they said, Wajih Barazi. And the officer said, where is Wajih Barazi? And dad raised his hand and he saluted him, saying, yes, sir. Apparently that officer was under my father's, ranking.
Wow.
When my father was an officer. And he told him, you go back home.
Mm.
Dad went back home. A few minutes later, he hears the shooting.
Oh, gosh.
And he said he will never, never forget that. And now we understand what survival guilt
of
is.
Of course.
So I remember growing up, since day one opposing Assad. We mm-hmm. couldn't say it out mm-hmm. loud because mm-hmm. Syrians believe that Assad can hear you, can see what you're writing, and can even go in your brain and know your thoughts. So we were always afraid, but we were always waiting for that day.
And what is it like in Hama now?
Very well. Wow, people are on the streets celebrating, so it's going very well.
And people are hopeful and optimistic, as you described.
They're very hopeful. There's a lot of discussions on what's now the results of what will come out after the opposition came in and controlled all Syria or most of Syria. Most of the people saying there, whoever comes now, there's no way he can be as bad as al-Assad and the family. There's no way. There's hope.
Zachary?
What is the mood now among Syrians like yourself who no longer live in the country? Are there people who are planning or already starting to move back?
Very good question. There are moods, not just one mood. Of course, there's still a status of unbelief, you know, or did it really happen? I mean, when it happened, it was Saturday night here. I remember sleeping very, very late, like 2 a.m, waking up. The first thing I turn on my phone to make sure this was not a dream.
Right.
So a lot of people still trying to digest what happened. The happiness could not last, unfortunately, very long because of the images of the prisoners and digging under the jails to see the secret, what they called the red room cell, which they couldn't reach. A lot of people talking about other locations for secret prisons. And there are many, many Syrians hundreds of thousands of Syrians who disappeared. There's no bodies. So you don't know if they're alive or dead or where they're buried. So this creates bitterness and anger inside. There's also the wonder of what's going to come yes. next. Who's going to rule Syria now? I think it happened so fast that there was not a proper preparation. We're seeing now that, for example, the prime minister, the ex regime, is there, and he said we will continue working and we will work with the new people. They appointed somebody yesterday from the opposition to work with him, but we don't have a government yet. So, and the main fear, actually, Zachary, would be the international interference. There have been proxy war in Syria, I think, for the past at least 10, 11 years. Everybody's fighting in Syria. At one point, we thought that we are an experimental lab. They tried weapons in Syria, bombing and wiping out neighborhoods. I think they even tried a different kind of tortures in Syria, and maybe there were some studies that we will learn about later. But the scary thing is that Russia, America, the Gulf countries, Iran, everybody was in Syria, but they were all not supporting the Syrian people. And for me, as a humanitarian worker, I look now at tools as the Security Council, the UN, and I see they've maybe done more damage than good. I hope one day we will come up with new tools that really fair to everybody, where me as a human being know that I deserve to live and others deserve to live. We're seeing on TV now, you know, people bombed in, for example, Gaza and Beirut. And we're watching it as if we're watching soap operas. And then we turn the TV off and right. we go to the gym or to go eat in a restaurant.
Right.
That's scary. That's a scary fact for tomorrow. International, you know, interference already started. Israel bombed Syria for the past two days. They say it's about 480 strikes. I think the last number I read on the news, wiping out the defense system. Now, I know there's fear, but we don't know who's ruling it. So, you know, I wish they bombed the defense system before, when Assad was bombing its own people. They probably gained some applause from the Syrians. So it's scary. It's going to be some hard times ahead of us.
What would you like the international community to do? If you had the opportunity to speak directly to the leaders of various countries, I hope they'll be listening to you on this podcast. What would you want them to do?
Stay away.
Stay away.
Yes. Yesterday, there were some Syrian activists saying to rebuild our countries, we will need international experience. Mm. We want to learn from how Germany rebuilt after World War II. We want to learn from the experience in Rwanda, in Burma. There are so many experiences similar to the Syrians that we can learn from, but we learn from them. We don't want them to come and tell us what to do or, you know, apply their agendas in Syria, which I know it will not happen. I don't think they're going to listen to me or do it. We would want the Syrians to be very, very wise. There's a lot of talk about revenge. You know, Syrian Assad used Syrians to kill each other. So
particularly his group, the Alawites, which is a small minority. Right.
Yes.
And that his family was a clan, right, from the Alawites.
Yes.
I mean, I am concerned that Sunnis in Syria, who are the majority, will attack the Alawites and others. Is that a real worry?
It is a worry. It is definitely a worry. And there's a lot of now activists calling for people to say we're going to have transitional justice. And this is something actually we teach in our program too. And that there will be a system where people, criminals, will be taken to justice. And but there is fear, you know. Women who were raped and men who were tortured. It's so difficult for me, who's sitting here in the U.S. enjoying democracy and freedom, to tell them, oh, hold yourselves.
Yeah, but, of course.
But so far, we haven't seen a lot of those actions, so we're hopeful. Mm.
Do you expect that the different rebel groups will be the basis for the new government? Or is there another group of Syrians who will step forward as the leaders?
Everybody should be included. Those young men who marched to Syria and now are really acting as the protectors of Syria, they should have a role. But there are many Syrians from different religions, different ethnicities, and everybody have to be included. That's why in 2011, I was in Syria, the people went out on the streets.
Yes.
They were, in the beginning, they didn't ask for any change in the government. They said, we just want some democracy, freedom. We want the corruption to stop. I saw that with my own eyes. So I know they were peaceful. But they were faced with beating and shooting. I remember twice I've been on the streets, not enough, but I couldn't afford more because I was busy taking care of my mom and working. I remember the first time it was a funeral for a young, three young men who were killed a day before, shot on the streets because they were out there calling freedom, freedom.
This is in Damascus.
This is in Damascus. It happened in the neighborhood where the UN building, where I worked, was. And I remember they said there's, because we were next to the cemetery, so the three young men will be brought to be buried, but they will be carried by their colleagues. Mm-hmm. So there will be tens of young people and family coming. That usually turns into a demonstration. So they said, close the UN building and leave because we don't know what will happen. We were already knowing that they might shoot at them. A friend of mine said, do you want to go on this funeral? I said, yes, I want to. So I joined them. I will never forget that feeling. And I don't think I can describe that feeling. There was this long, narrow street. We ran to join, and I see a river of people, thousands of people. And all of a sudden, there's a group of women, maybe 50, 60. And we were all chanting freedom, and we were chanting for the murderers.
What are the words you use? What are the words in...
You want me to say it in Arabic or English?
In Arabic, and Syrian Arabic.
Yes. To say it in English first, they will call, of course, for freedom, which is Hirriye, Hirriye. And then they will tell the mother of the murderer that we are all your children. مش شهيد نحن أولادك.
Wow.
And I start chanting with them. Yes. And I was feeling a bit cold and maybe felt like I was flying above the cloud. Huh. I was very light. We got to where they were all meeting, and they laid the three bodies on the floor. And then there was a sheikh, a Muslim priest, praying. And then one young man turned to us and they said, please leave for all the young ladies. And we said, why? They said, the snipers on the building. We just saw the snipers. That means they want to shoot us.
Oh my
so
gosh.
Please go, because we cannot protect you. We're all going to run soon. And we start walking away. Minutes later, I start hearing the shooting.
Oh.
And again, you feel like, oh my God. And you're thinking, you want to run. We were running away, kept running toward the main street. But you're wondering how many people now on the floor, how many more young men are dying. So, you know, this actually motivated me to go out again. I told my friend next time.
Yes.
The next time it was a massacre in El Hole. It's a small town where the regime blamed terrorists. But later on, videos showed that it was people from the regime who went and slaughtered large numbers in this small village. And we decided to go on the street, not to say anything except to have a moment of silence. And the organizers made sure that the people that they will go to a little square in Old Town Damascus, they are Sunni, Christian, Druze, and Alawite. Mm. So we were about 40, 50 people standing there, and he comes in and he says, guys, we're here for a moment of silence. You can pray in whatever religion you are, and then each one will go to his house. So it's like 2-3 minutes, event. And we stood there, and I looked to the left, and I saw those men, security, Syrian security, with the big black sticks or electricity wires, coming toward us. And I said, okay, they're going to come and ask us to leave. No, the beating started. And I remember running, a shop owner waves to me to come in. I go in. He says, are you okay? And I said, yes. He said, no, your leg. Apparently, they hit me on my leg. I didn't feel it. And I was screaming, why? But I understand exactly why the young man kept going. It's kind of addictive because
sure.
you go after your aspirations and dreams.
Sure.
You don't want to let go.
Sure. In some ways, you don't have a choice. If you want to live a humane life, you can't survive that way.
Yes.
I mean, it's one of the reasons you left Syria, right?
Yes. It was actually a few months after that when my husband told me there's no hope. Let's leave. And we came to the States. This is before that, this is where we got our education and we lived for like 10 years. So went back to Syria trying to do something and then we left again and we've been in the U.S. since then.
Wow. Zachary, this is a lot to take in for us, for Americans, for people who are accustomed to difficult politics, but not this level of violence and brutality. And there's so much violence and brutality we're seeing in our world today, particularly in the Middle East. And it's not new, obviously, but we're becoming more aware of it, at least. How do you think young people like yourself are reacting to this? Is this something that's resonating with your colleagues and others who are looking out at the world? Is this something that will leave a permanent influence on the way we think about the world, or is it just more of the same?
Well, I think certainly the images are deeply moving for a lot of young people who see the images of sort of jubilant Syrians celebrating the end of the Assad regime. And I think there's a strange way in which all of us have sort of grown up with this war in the background, hearing about it on the news. It's sort of the headlines that we often try to ignore. And so to see it end like this, I think is very hopeful, or at least we hope it's ended, the violence and all. So I think there is something very hopeful in this moment. I think there's also a lot of uncertainty. And I think certainly one reaction that people have to this, I'm not sure quite how widespread it is, but certainly our president-elect had this reaction to it. None of our business, or we shouldn't be involved. And there is a sense that this is something that is happening so far away, and also something that we don't really know or understand.
Do you share that view, Zachary?
No, certainly not. I think there's a deep relevance that, as we've seen, and it's not just moving emotionally, but it shows us, for one, for me, I think, as I said in my poem, it shows how sudden these things can be. How in moments when we've all sort of not just lost hope, but at least in the U.S., for those of us who don't have a personal connection, sort of stopped paying attention, how sometimes a group of people can seize the agenda again and really change things, and how it's often in those moments when the things seem the most stagnant that the change happens.
Sure, sure. You know, horrible regimes last a long time, and then they fall fast. And I think your poem captures that. May, for our final words here, so many of our listeners, I'm sure, care deeply about what's happening. They might not be personally connected, but I think many of our listeners are humanitarians and care about humanitarian issues deeply. And I know many of our listeners work on refugee issues, maybe refugee issues at the U.S. border and elsewhere. What do you think the ordinary American listening, what can they do? How can they make some small positive difference and offer some help?
Oh, wow, that's a big question. I don't know if I'm capable of giving answers. We're really hopeful, and I think it's in the hand of, I don't want to say just young people, but like anybody who wants to do something. I was listening to Zachary's words, and I'm like, yes, there's hope. Because there's words and there's actions.
Yes.
The words are beautiful, but they disappear. I remember being in D.C., and I visited the Jewish museum, and there was a section for Syria,
mm-hmm.
and it says never again,
right.
Because the pictures of the Syrians who were taken by a person called Caesar, and there was a Caesar action sanctions on Syria because of him, the pictures were similar to the Holocaust.
Sure.
And I remember said, oh my God, never again. Yes, that's how it should be. And it should be never again. Never again for anybody. I'm sure there's people in here who can make a difference, who can do something, and knowledge, awareness.
Yes.
And there's perspectives also. We teach also in our program that judging is very difficult because we have different perspectives. how the Americans looking now at Syria, the images that's coming out, some Americans might think in a way, Syrians might think in a different way. We have to accept that. We are different people. What the Syrians want may be different from what the American wants. But we have to let be, you know. I'm hoping really that people will stand by the Syrians, help them recover and rebuild and enjoy what they want to enjoy.
You know, I think your point about knowledge and awareness, and that's more than just words, as you say. It's more than also just doing things. It's paying attention and caring. And I think one of the most hopeful things is that Syria's back in the news. The civil war had been going on. What you described, what you experienced personally, May, what you so courageously shared with us here, that was happening, and most of the world was not paying attention. Now the world is paying attention, and I think all of us as citizens who care about democracy, wherever we live and whatever our backgrounds, we have to continue to pay attention and demand that people are treated as human beings. I don't think, as you pointed out, that Americans or Europeans are in a position to tell Syria how to run its country going forward. We have too many of our own problems, and you know our track record is pretty mixed at best. But by caring about the human beings and by encouraging and demanding that human beings are treated in a basic humane way, the opposite of what you experienced, it does seem that that can have an important role, don't you think?
Yes, definitely. And that's what a lot of Syrian activists saying now. We want to use the experience of the international world. We want to learn from you. We need your expertise and help, not interference.
Yes, yes.
So this is, yes, definitely everything you said was 100% correct. We will be watching for the next few days and see how things will turn. And let's hope. It might be a messy period, which is normal after all what we've been through. And hopefully then Syrians will have a normal life, just like anybody else.
Yes, yes. So, Zachary, how about we close with your poem one more time?
Okay. At once. From 1,000 miles away, they watch the freedom of their land return and see the faces from the dungeons long since disappeared and hear the laughter of their countrymen for once at peace, finding in their own children's eyes the love that they had lost. So swiftly does the tyrant fall, not slowly but at once. So swiftly do the gunshots end, not slowly but at once. And just like that can hope return. Not slowly, but at once.
May Barazi, thank you so much for courageously sharing your experiences with us and for giving us more reason for hope in a very difficult situation. Zachary, thank you for your moving poem. This week, you outdid yourself. I think you captured so much of the humanity of this moment for us, Zachary, and as only a poem really can. So thank you for that, Zachary. And thank you most of all to our loyal listeners for subscribing to our Substack and listening to our podcast and for staying aware and focused on the human beings in places like Syria who are struggling with enormous challenges, but also enormous hopes. Thank you for joining us for this episode of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harris Coudini. Stay tuned for a new episode every week. You can find This Is Democracy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. See you next time.